When it comes to hard work, there's one important rule. Pick the right tool for the right job. That's why Chevy offers a family of Silverado pickup trucks designed just for the job. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and put a Silverado in your toolbox.
Today is Thursday. It's May 26, 2017.
Start again. It's Friday, John.
Today is Friday. Good catch.
There you go. We print guys, really. Anyway.
Today is Friday. It's May 26, 2017. It's 11:17 in the morning, and this is The Mincing Rascals. I'm John Williams, a weekly podcast that we record here at WGN Radio. You can hear portions of this on my Saturday morning show at 11:10 on WGN.
I'm Steve Bertrand, the host of The Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
I'm Eric Zorn, the Embraceable Tribune columnist. My column returns to the paper on Sunday and runs Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday thereafter.
It's been too long.
It has been a while.
Embraceable, is that a shout out to the president's inability to shake hands with foreign leaders?
That's just what everybody says about me, that's all.
No, actually, like
Donald Trump. Everybody's saying it. Everybody's saying it. I've heard it from lots of people.
Everybody says embraceable.
Well, he's embraceable, but I actually saw a news story this week which had a body language expert sort of dissect his embrace, his handshake, how he greets or is greeted by people. It's fascinating. I mean, he's the alpha male. He offers his hand as a gesture. It's sort of like...
But he does it in a way of submission, right?
Right, right. I know, that's the interesting thing. It's a submissive, the open palm, but then he gets you and then he grabs you, throws you off your balance a little bit. Remember when Neil Gorsuch shook his hand? and then you're kind of wobble, but now you're in his firm grip. Now he sort of has you off balance. I don't know that he's thinking about this. Surely he's not, but it's what happens time and again.
My understanding was that Trump didn't like to shake hands, that he's a germaphobe. So maybe he's just learning how to shake. He's like a child.
I think it's that, and I also think that he doesn't know how to mug for a press photo as a politician. You know what I mean? Guys who have kind of worked their way up through the ranks know the drill. He doesn't.
Well, he clearly doesn't. He's not aware of it because he's cheesing with Lavrov in his, you know, Oval Office when you would have rather been Stern, right? So he doesn't have that wherewithal.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, if you got to be aware of the situation and you don't want to be seen, you know, chumming up with the Russians, it's just not a good idea. You can be seen with them, but have a stern face. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that he actually doesn't know how to do the photo op handshake very well.
I think that these handshakes, some of them have been, whatever. It's just a handshake.
But you also don't like sort of how it looked when they're all sitting there yucking it up, him and his Russian buddies.
No, I thought that's what you were saying, just a sort of an awareness of taking my picture.
I'll give you that point, right, too, that he really doesn't realize how every moment. I mean, look at the pictures with the Pope. Not that he could have done anything about that.
Right.
But we're watching this president on his, as he put it, my first big trip. We're watching this president learn how to play on the international stage. And it's something that usually these people have more experience.
Right. I mean, he did body slam the prime minister of Montenegro.
I know. Now you're confusing the stories.
Oh, yeah.
That was a great moment, though, on video where he knocks the guy from Montenegro out of the way to get
in front. Yeah, I didn't know where he was from. Clearly, Trump didn't either. Maybe it wouldn't have mattered. But, yeah, he was so interested in getting in the front of that little scrum of leaders,
right,
that he literally pushed the Montenegro guy out of the way.
And not to be too picky and negative, and this is unfair, but he did it, and then he gets in front,
right,
and then he gets puffy.
Right,
you know,
and then he opens his suit coat, rebuttons it, sort of asserts his shoulders.
But the Prime Minister of Montenegro, he's the newest member, so it's kind of like a fraternity hazing thing, I think.
Like, you think Trump knew who he was or that he's the newest member of NATO? I don't think this is giving him way too much credit.
It's also another example of one of those video moments which may or may not have really reflected what happened.
Oh, you mean like Melania seeming to knock his hand away several times?
Right.
No, the Melania moment, I believe we've discussed on this podcast before, I think was a genuine tell. But the picture that he took with the Pope, where the Pope has a dour look and Trump is beaming, was unfair.
Why? There's a great picture of Obama and the same Pope when the Pope is beaming.
Yeah, well, but you know what? The reverse of what we just said is true also.
The Pope probably was beaming at one point with Trump standing next to him.
And there's pictures of that, and there's pictures of him looking dour. I mean, there's a picture of the Pope and a president with every conceivable expression because they take 1,000 photos.
My favorite tweet, though, was of the picture, and it said, "Please don't post this on social media. I'm afraid my boss will see it." Signed the Pope.
The Pope, yeah. Right.
I like the one where they photoshopped the kid from The Omen into that.
Damien is sitting in there, standing between the Pope and the president, yeah. Well, but I mean, optics, I guess, do matter. And so there's the president also trying to make some hay with the NATO allies. And he's giving them tough love. He is telling them, I, to be honest with you, if Barack Obama had delivered the message that Donald Trump had, I wondered if it would have been getting the scolding in the American press that it did.
Well, first of all, he has been so harshly critical of NATO. And his speech, he was like the first president ever, I guess, not to underscore the importance of, is it Article 5?
Article 5, yeah.
The mutual defense obligation that
which
NATO
was invoked after 9/11.
Which was invoked only once and only for us.
And instead he's picking on them about that they're not putting enough money into their own defense. Now, it's not a bad point to make. It's probably not, shouldn't be the focus of your remarks to these guys. I mean, you're going over there to bolster NATO, presumably, right? You're not over there to say, hey, pay your bills, folks. You're not like a bill collector.
That's what he campaigned on. He said, I'm going to tell them they need to pay their fair share.
Right.
And to be honest with you, I don't know why they don't. I do know some of their explanations, but at the end of the day, in the Tribune today, it said his remarks Thursday, the American First President reprised his core critique about what he called allies' chronic underpayments and did so face-to-face with his counterparts in NATO. Several looked disgusted and some exchanged glances and whispers. That's reading as though he did something bad there.
Well, it's
he had the balls to tell them right to their face, you guys owe.
But it's grandstanding. That's what it is. It's like trying to shame them in public. It's the kind of thing, if he goes behind the scenes and talks to them and says, hey, look, you know, you guys aren't putting 2% of your GDP into defense or exactly whatever the deal is. You know, you've got to start doing that. But to make it such a main thrust of your remarks in front of them, it feels like political grandstanding to me, not like diplomacy.
Right.
This is diplomacy, and he's not good at it.
Here's the thing. They're speaking, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was at the dedication of a memorial or something to Article 5. They were
right
at an Article 5 event. Yeah, he's standing next to debris from when Article 5 was attacked to protect us at an Article 5 event. And these people out there who are afraid of a growing Russian threat, worried that maybe he's too cozy with that threat, were hoping to hear from him that the U.S. remains committed to Article 5. That's what you say. And then you can go on secondarily to point out that, and by the way, we're paying way more than you guys are, and you're not living up to your agreement.
We do need
you to come up on that. But for it to be the focal point of a very short speech when the world is waiting to hear him say the other words was either tone deaf or really, really playing back to the people here.
Or it was a statement of his priorities. I mean, really, what is more important to the United States? That we have to continue to pay an inordinate amount of the cost, or that these European allies feel safer because we're going to tell them
Wait a minute. You tell me, what's more important to the United States, that we continue to pay the way we are, or that we're willing to go to war for Montenegro, the guy who he just pushed aside? Because that's what Article 5 says. It says that we will go to war if Russia invades Montenegro.
Yeah.
Montenegro and the other countries want to know if we're going to stand up to that, paying the bills thing, that's a decade-old thing, and he's right. They should pay their fair share. But at this moment, at that event, Article 5 deserved more attention than it got.
That speech wasn't for them. It was for us. It was for the people that voted for Donald Trump. He didn't care how the guy in Montenegro, he pushed him out of the way. I don't think he cares how Angela Merkel feels about it. He's talking to the people that voted for him, saying, I looked those people square in the face and said, you guys owe. And some people like that. Eric doesn't.
I don't like it, but these are maybe the same people who this week have been talking about what his priorities are looking at when he's out of the country and his budget is introduced. And you look at what it does to a lot of his supporters, a lot of the poor people, a lot of the working class people are going to lose big time if his budget goes through, which essentially cuts all kinds of social service programs and gives big tax breaks to the wealthy.
Yeah.
That kind of, I mean, they say, I didn't build the wall for you, I didn't get rid of Obamacare. And I didn't bring jobs back, and I gave a huge tax cut to the world. But I did tell those scoundrels over. I told Montenegro I gave them what for. I think you may be right. You may have been playing to the home crowd, but there are times and places to play to the home crowd.
Yeah.
That was not one of them.
Well, last point about this: Angela Merkel said, "It is not isolation or the building of walls that will make us successful." Boom! Drop the mic, Angela.
He's not going to shake her hand.
Yeah, no
ever.
Kidding. Okay, so we can leave the president's trip. Although the one last observation I have.
Go ahead.
Well, I wish he had invited Sean Spicer.
Oh, yeah, that would have been gracious.
I mean, Sean Spicer has on his bucket list as a devout Catholic to meet the Pope, and he just can't make that guy's life more any less miserable than he continually does.
You know, in the reporting on it is that it was clear. Spicer said this is something he really wanted to do.
And,
so it almost seemed like it was a conscious decision
to not
allow him. The Pope's
peeps said, well, but, and by the way, that would be the Pope's peeps, said that they're very strict on the numbers that can be in the room. And somebody had to get cut. You know, it's like when you're doing an invitation list, and we love all these people, but there's not room in the Pope's office for everybody. So
John's planning a wedding.
I know. It's a very painful process. Okay, so we'll leave that. Talk to me about the body slam. You referenced it earlier, Steve.
Well, you know, it's amazing. We now have, or will have, probably by the time you hear this, a sitting member of Congress who's charged with assaulting a reporter.
Greg Gianforte.
And you've got the president overseas saying, this was a great win.
This was a great win in Montana.
Yeah.
So here's my question for the table. Should we recap the story just real quickly? The reporter from The Economist is...
No. The Guardian.
Guardian, I'm sorry. One of those foreign papers. He's over there. He's asking a question about the CBO score, which is another big story of the week. And he's asking a question, and the guy, we don't have video of it, but apparently, allegedly, grabs and throws him down, breaks his glasses.
Well, here's the audio of it.
The CBO score, because you were waiting to make your decision about health care until you saw the bill, and it just came out.
And what you thought we'll talk to you about that later.
Yeah, but there's not going to be time. I'm just curious if you have the
speak
right
with
now.
Shane, please.
But you don't
I'm sick and tired of you guys. The last guy that came here, you did the same thing. Get the hell out of here.
Jesus.
Get the hell out of here. The last guy did the same thing. You were the Guardian?
Yes, and you just broke my glasses.
You, the last guy did the same damn thing.
You just body slammed me and broke my glasses.
Get the hell out of here.
You'd like me to get the hell out of here, I'd also like to call the police. Can I get you guys' names?
Hey, you gotta leave.
He just body slammed me.
You gotta leave.
Okay, well, the question I have for the table is, do you think that played well with Montana voters or poorly? Because I thought, well, of course, this disgusts we fancy people here and the liberal Democrats in Chicago, but how is this going to play in Montana? And they're going to say, this pointy-headed foreign pencil-neck geek comes and harasses our good old boy here, and so he opens a can of whoop-ass on him. That's great.
Yeah, well, that's what bothered me the most about it was the statement afterward, because the words he used... And it was like a wink and a nod. Hey, you people are going to agree with me, right? We beat up on a liberal media guy, on a liberal reporter.
Liberal journalist.
I mean, that's insulting if you're a Montanan and you don't feel that way, because that's basically what he's saying. You know, it's okay if it's a liberal, quote-unquote, member of the media, an enemy of the people.
Well, here's the campaign for Gianforte said after this. Jacobs, the reporter, was asked to leave. This is their statement. After asking Jacobs to lower the recorder, Jacobs declined. Greg then attempted to grab the phone that was pushed in his face. Jacobs grabbed Greg's wrist and spun away from Greg, pushing them both to the ground. It's unfortunate that this aggressive behavior from a liberal journalist created this scene at our campaign volunteer barbecue.
So they're saying that the reporter grabbed the candidate for Congress and spun him around and knocked him to the ground. Think of that. There's only one person saying that, and that's that statement.
And not the four people that were there from
Fox News. And I also think, and Gianforte gave an apology in his victory speech.
He did, yeah.
Last night.
Said he'd made a mistake.
And it was actually a fairly long apology. I mean,
well,
it was not just
a couple
words.
Well,
do you
guys think we're on the cusp of making more out of this than it warrants?
No. You have a candidate for federal office who attacked a member of the media asking an incredibly legitimate, the question of the day about the CBO score. And it apparently got him votes.
This wasn't a gotcha question. It wasn't, it wasn't like, well, we found you have 55 unpaid parking tickets. What do you say to that?
And, apparently this guy had issues with an earlier Guardian story, but it wasn't from Jacobs. And who cares if it was? You don't have license to knock someone down.
But my question is, again, do you think he paid a price for this? And I mean, he won the election, and apparently, a lot of the voting in Montana takes place early. So they said a 2/3 of the vote had already been
cast. I heard everything. John had an editor on, said 50%.
So was there exit polling yesterday, Don? Did this hurt him in any way? Did he win among people who voted on Thursday?
The polls before it had showed him up anywhere from 2 to 8%, and I think he won by 6 or so. So there's not much damage there. Yeah,
a number of newspapers in Montana rescinded their endorsement of him, but it was way too late. Yeah. Way too late.
Well, you know, and we've talked about this. I think it should be as easy to vote as possible. This is kind of a case against early voting.
Oh, yeah.
Because if 50% or 70% of the people had already voted, they didn't have all the data in that the others did who voted yesterday.
In some states, you can rescind your vote.
Right.
But, yeah, that's another trip.
Who's going to do that?
put the assaulting congressman in office.
But I think Donald Trump has created an environment where this is okay, where it's bullying behavior. It's violent behavior, but I believe that Donald Trump has helped create this environment.
He's turned to crowds at rallies and said, he said from his podium, his presidential podium, that the press is the enemy of the American people. If you did brackets for crazy, hateful, or unfortunate things the president said and did, I mean, and that it could be consequential and trivial, I would put that in my final four, yeah. And I don't know who the other three
physically
are.
Physically attacking your enemy is not necessarily such a bad thing.
Right. Well, listen, if we're at war with Afghanistan or somebody, then, yeah, we get to kill them, but that's because they're our enemy. He said that the media in America are the enemy of the American people.
And in Sicily earlier today, he turned, and I guess unsolicited to the camera, said, what was it, really great win.
Great victory in Montana.
Which just speaks, and it was a good, I mean, it's a win, so, you know, enjoy the win, celebrate it. It's one on the Republican column, but it's just a little tone deafness, I think, or it's incredibly tuned in, I'm not sure which, to,
well,
you know, just
Eric's point, yeah.
Step away from it maybe a little bit.
What's your answer to your own question? Do you think
I think it helped him. I think it helped this guy, you know, I hope that there's some research done on this when we find out, but my guess is that it helped him, that there was a sentiment like, heck yeah. These nosy out-of-towners come in for writing for their foreign publications.
You know, I talked to two editors of newspapers in Montana, Billings and Butte, and they both could not have been more erudite, articulate, fair-minded, and they said, we're embarrassed by this, that maybe these are just the journalists there, and so it's not representative of the ranchers, but they said this was embarrassing.
I've seen some graphics about the amount of money that the Republicans spent on this race. It's huge.
The total budget
was
$17 million.
And the Democrats did not put up
for Montana.
Democrats didn't put up a great candidate, right? He's like a
country and western
cowboy.
Singer, yeah.
Well, that's a good thing.
Well, but I'm really sick and tired of the Democrats saying, yeah, but we got close. You know, they're like, hey, just the numbers here or in Kansas shows that we're really cutting into the lead. They need to win something.
Oh, really, Steve?
Yeah.
It's not going to happen overnight. But if you want to see a tidal shift in Congress or in America, we're finally fed up with Donald Trump. How are we going to express that, if that's what you're talking about?
Well, I think the Georgia congressional race with Ossoff is going to be the one where it's going to be a real bellwether.
This was Montana. I mean, it's a red state.
Yeah, but Montana elects statewide Democrats. Democratic governors. Okay. They've got a senator now.
I want to talk about the Laquan McDonald killing. And the trial has not yet begun. But Jason Van Dyke's attorney, Daniel Herbert, said about Laquan McDonald's shooting. And we all know the story of Laquan McDonald's shooting. About a year and a half ago in October 2014, he's walking down the street away from cops. He had that night punctured the tire with a knife of a squad car and had been doing things that had the cops now trying to get him. And there he is going down a street in Chicago. And Jason Van Dyke pulls up, gets out, and shoots him 14 times.
16 times.
16 times?
Yeah. I think it was in 14 seconds after he got
16, okay.
Anyway.
Okay. His attorney, Van Dyke's attorney, says, yes, it was an ugly shooting. Ugly from the standpoint it showed a graphic image. Not unlike most shootings where a police officer shoots an individual. The point is, it was business as usual. If a firefighter arrives on the scene of a fire and climbs on the roof, takes out an axe and cuts the roof open to ventilate the roof, are we going to charge the firefighter with criminal damage to property? Of course not. It's preposterous. You cannot be charged criminally for duties you are required by law to do. I guess if you're Van Dyke, that's all you got. I mean, what a sad defense.
That was a fairly offensive analogy, the firefighter analogy, because if you watch that video, you'll see that Laquan McDonald literally is walking, and he's walking away from the cops, and Van Dyke gets out of his car, and within, I think it's 14 seconds, I mean, hardly any time at all. He didn't get a chance to.
I think it's six. I'll look it up.
Was it just anyway? In a very short time, he just opens fire on him and keeps shooting. And but this is going to be the defense, and you know, brace yourself for it because this is what we're going to hear. I think that the business as usual line is not going to play well. Well, he just means that this is what cops are told to do, and this is what cops are supposed to do. If you've got an armed suspect, and he did have a 3-inch knife on him, fleeing the scene, and he's walking away, arguably. He's not walking toward the cops. He's not walking, you know, completely away from them. He's walking at an angle away from them. But he's walking away that you're supposed to take him down. And so he's saying this is no different from a guy with a gun in his hand who has just shot somebody running away. And when a suspect has a gun in his hand, clearly has a gun, that person is a clear and imminent danger to somebody else. And cops have a right to have a duty at that point to take
that. That's what he said. This was their duty. They right. were supposed to shoot Laquan McDonald. And if I'm Van Dyke's family, I'm just shaking my head. I think, oh, God, we're screwed. He's never getting out. This is a preposterous defense. What an offensive thing to say.
What's a better one?
I don't know.
Yeah.
All you're going to need is one juror who's going to say like this is a cop being a cop is really hard and that's very true and this is a tough situation and this guy comes in and things are all going crazy around
it's
him.
All testosterone in that
and
video.
And you're going to need one juror out of 12 to say, you know what, it's not murder. It's not. It's like maybe he used bad judgment, but it's not murder. That's why I've predicted that he's not going to be convicted of first degree murder. It'd be some lesser charge and be my guess.
But he is charged with first-degree murder, but I guess it could be second-degree or something like that?
The judge could allow the jurors to consider lesser crimes, right?
Yes, they can do lesser-included charges, I think. But this is what you're going to hear, and this is what you hear when you talk to police about this, which is that these are split-second decisions that people make,
was 6 seconds, by the way, Eric.
Six, okay.
6 seconds. So he pulls up. And 6 seconds as McDonald is actually parallel to them. He's been walking towards them, and now he's sort of even with them. But you're right, still walking in a direction that would take him away from them. Within 6 seconds after he gets out of the car, he empties his what do they call it? His
service weapon, revolver, his whatever. Yeah.
Service revolver. The judge says something really interesting at the hearing before this trial begins. Is it Gauguin?
Gaughan.
Gauchan. I guess he's an interesting character, this judge, huh? So he announced in the packed courtroom, I'm reading from the Tribune, that both motions had been denied by the defense. One man apparently snapped his fingers multiple times in approval. Get up here, the judge said. The man, identified as Moises Bernal, stepped up to the bench, and the judge asked him why he came to the hearing. The man paused, looked at the defense table, and said, to see a racist murderer on trial, he said, to gasps from the courtroom gallery. The judge found him in contempt of court and ordered him jailed on $40,000 bail. I'm shocked at that.
Would it have been different had he given a different answer?
He said, I'm waiting for the next
justice
case to come.
I want to see justice served.
He said, I'm not going to allow this to turn into some sort of three-ring circus. For the rest of you who've been acting like ladies and gentlemen, God love you, and I hope you come back.
Well, you know what? Snapping your fingers in court is not good. You can't allow these kind of displays in court. And I get that. But if he's going to punish him for what he said when he called him up and asked him, I mean, the guy could have said, I came here because you got an ugly face and it amuses me that a judge could be this ugly. That's not contempt of court. You asked him. He's got a perfect right to speak.
He's supposed to respond, right.
Supposed to speak and say what's on his mind.
The jailing is because of this, not
crap. You can't be snapping your fingers in the courtroom. That is contempt of
really?
Court.
And in cracking down, the judge invited worse behavior.
What do you mean?
Well, if he was worried about the snapping, he might have just sentenced him or convicted him then.
Right then
by
and
bringing him up and saying, hey, fella, what brought you here? He made the situation worse. Right? It's worse for a guy to stand up in court and say, this guy's a racist murderer.
Right, because presumably if he had said, just to see you do such a great job as I've heard you've done every day, maybe the judge
would a handsome man on the bench.
Well, we'll continue to follow this story, but it does not look good.
The atmospherics of this trial are going to be very troubling and bizarre. I think you're going to have a lot of protesters there. They have to have special ways for Van Dyke to get in and out of the courthouse because there are people who are giving him a hard time. That's justice needs to be conducted in the courtroom, and it needs to be done in a dignified manner, which is what one of the basic parts of our court system. We don't have howling mobs in there.
Do you feel bad for Van Dyke?
No. I don't feel bad.
Neither
no,
of you do.
No.
Why not?
Because you just said he shot a man walking away from him 16 times in 6 seconds.
Why do you think he did that?
I don't have any idea.
I mean, now I'll be his defense, or at least I'll try and look sympathetically. This is a guy who every day gets up, puts on his boots, and tries to serve and protect the people of Chicago. And for some reason, he snapped and made a terrible decision that day, and a man died. He did not get up that morning wanting to kill somebody. He did not want to throw his career away. He didn't want to do any of that. He made a mistake. He made a mistake, and he's going to be punished for it. I feel bad for that whole scene I just described, including the officer in it. He's not the gangbanger. He's a police officer who is...
You make a good point. I mean, you make a good... He didn't set out to... Which is why I think first-degree murder is going to be a stretch. I think he reacted impulsively. I think that when you carry a gun and you're charged with protecting the citizens, that you have to... You can't snap. You just can't do that. So it's not just a mistake. I mean, it was a terrible thing that he did. And I think that, you know, if he figures out... If he had, you know, maybe done more to apologize for that, to explain himself... we found a lesser charge to plead to.
No way. I mean, the guy, how many times did he shoot him?
16
times. I'm sorry, you can't apologize your way. I mean, and that's not a mistake. The mistake maybe would be one or two, but by 13, 14, 15,
he
16.
He must have just, I do not know what was going on in that officer's head, but the Tribune story today says that he was getting ready to reload when the other officers told him to stop. I mean, it's 16 times.
Yeah.
The guy is dead on the ground.
Right.
He's still shooting him. It's amazing.
I think snapping is probably accurate, don't you think? I mean,
I suppose a sustained snap. I mean, not just a hair, you know, hair trigger or whatever, but then
right.
to have gone almost into a psychotic episode where you're going to reload.
Yeah, you know, if I was his defense attorney, I'd run some of that at him, and not this is what he was supposed to do.
Well, but I mean, look, we all have to be protected, and we have to be. It's not allowable for someone to be shot down and then for the police officer to say, I had a psychotic episode.
Yeah.
There's got to be punishment for that.
Yeah, I didn't say there isn't. All I'm asking for is a little appreciation for what these guys do. They have to do the hardest jobs, and they have to make decisions.
And John, I think you make a perfectly reasonable point, and I think that point has a chance of really gaining purchase on a jury. You don't need 12 people to agree with what you just said. You need one.
Well, I'm available.
It's interesting to me because you are in his head, in his heart, trying to be. Eric, on the other hand, is in the jury box talking about who's gonna prevail in the trial.
Imagine Foreman John Williams is making this argument.
I would. Too.
John's
and
gone.
Saying,
yeah.
saying, he's saying this guy. I mean, just the words that he used. Like he got up in the morning. He's got I think he has kids. I know he's got a wife. And he didn't set out to kill somebody. And he gets in this situation, highly charged situation, and he makes a mistake. You're gonna put him away for first degree murder? No. And I can see you making that argument in the jury room, and the other jurors maybe fighting you back and getting into. I mean, could have a hung jury, I suppose. But that's my prediction. Is that
well? If you ask me how I would vote to convict.
First degree murder.
Maybe not that.
Well, that's his point. Yeah.
That's my point.
And I want to make it clear, the job that they do, I can't imagine doing that. I don't care if you are in Englewood or if you're in Winnetka. You know, every day when you get up, you put on all of that gear and you are always this close. You're putting yourself in a position of peril, not just by being attacked, but by making a fatal mistake yourself.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine it. And so I'm wholly supportive of the police, but I just think you 16 times.
And the three of us around this table, when we leave for work in the morning, there's no question at all we're going to come back at home safe at night, you know?
Right.
But. These men and women in the police department, that is a question, and their families deal with that too. I mean, it's a very hard job.
I mean, I think about not just, as I just said, being shot or attacked or something, but you are always you are walking such a fine line with everything you do that if you do something the least bit incorrect, you know, you could be making a fatal mistake for yourself. It's hard to imagine, but given all of that, there also has to be people who varied so widely as this guy did,
so
there has to be punishment.
I see so many stories, Steve, where the cops are acting out of anger. You know, this...
They can't.
The Chicago Police Department has a program now trying to teach them de-escalation strategies, and I hope they're receptive to it, but they have so... I don't want to say chip on their shoulder, but they come in so angry because people aren't doing, because they're walking down the middle of the street. We told you to stop walking down the middle of the street. God damn it, stop walking down the middle of the street. And now you're chasing him in your car, and then you finally pull up ahead and wait for him, and he's coming, and he still won't do what you want him to do. And that's when
you pull out your nightstick and you beat on him or something.
Yeah, I know. You wonder why they just didn't find some other measure to subdue him. Here's our recommendations. Steve, can you do one or you got to go?
Yeah, I'm going to go. I'm reading a book or just finished a book called Snowblind, and I'm leading a group of WGN listeners to Iceland.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so.
Are you really going to Iceland now?
Yeah, I'll be here next week, but not the week
Eric,
after.
Eric, you got to get in on this thing.
I know.
Come on,
know.
Buddy. I'll
What's
set you up
on?
With a trip. SteveBertrandTravel.com.
Where would you go if you
Hawaii.
It's got to be Europe.
Got to be Europe?
Yeah.
Oh, Germany.
Okay, right. There you go.
I'll set you up. September, good? You want to do Oktoberfest?
I got to check with my bosses and clear it with the ethics people. And
you just
say,
did.
No, so
we just did. We said it was okay.
Anyway,
so Snowblind is this novel by Ragnar Johansson, and it just happens to be, it's a crime drama like every other, but it's set in Iceland. It's a new book out this year, and he's got a series going. And he used to translate English to Icelandic. So I was reading that one kind of in preparation of the trip. Snowblind.
Okay. My recommendation this week, it's always something we're reading, watching, listening to, or Kristen introduced
drinking.
Us to drinking. Here's the drink that I just recently discovered, and it was really awesome. I had it at, I don't think I mentioned this, Texas de Brazil, the sort of Brazilian steakhouse downtown. So they take simple syrup and muddled lime and just kind of squish that in. Glass of ice with then a kind of Brazilian rum, but I just bought Bacardi, and a shot of that, however much you want, and then top it with Sprite or club soda, depending on how sweet you like it. Not the most inventive thing in the world, but always had a refreshing drink.
Where is this recipe posted? Is it maybe on our page, our Facebook page or something?
It will appear at the end of this podcast.
Okay, good. Excellent. I've got two. One is Master of None, the Netflix series. You watch that?
My son finished it.
He did. I'm partway through season two. Aziz Ansari is the co-writer and star of it. It's fun. It's thought-provoking, mostly funny. Anyway, great little series. I think of 10 episodes a season, mm-hmm. something like that. And the other way is this product called Uncrustables. Have you ever heard of that? Smucker's put them out in 2000. I just heard about it last couple days ago. What it is this little pouch of peanut butter and jelly sandwich without the crust, and it comes in a little plastic wrapper, and they have peanut butter and jelly and like really spongy white bread. And my friend Chuck Berman bought it on our golf trip, and he was giving them to us when we were hungry. And I don't normally eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, but boy, are they good. This is a terrific little snack to get in, a little bit more nutritious than like a Suzy Q or something.
I have to say, the way you described it sounds really disgusting. It's better than it sounds, I guess.
Peanut butter and jelly sandwiches are better than maybe. Do you ever eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches?
Oh, sure. I'm a PBJ fan.
Oh, you do? Well, you should try an Uncrustable.
But white bread?
Yeah, well.
And rolled up and prepackaged so it's not gooey and kind of soggy?
It's very gooey. Very gooey and kind of soggy. Yeah, it's soft, yeah.
It works, though.
It worked for me. It really did. Maybe I was just hungry on the golf course, but I was thinking, boy, where have these been all my life?
And that's Eric Zorn's recommendation. Steve Bertrand, thank you for joining us on the Mincing Rascals podcast. We're normally joined by Kristen McQuarrie. She'll join us again another day. Bob Ferguson is our engineer. Thank you for that, Bob. Mincing Rascals are produced by L.F. Garris. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can also listen online on the WGN Plus app or WGNradio.com. Just click on the WGN Plus tab. The Mincing Rascals podcast is a presentation of the WGN Plus Podcast Network. You can also catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.